Dogs and cats and birds and rats, and welcome to Heroic Beasts, the comic book anthropomorphics podcast. I'm your host, Brink Bunny. Thank you for joining me here for episode 2 of this little podcast experiment. Just to sort of sum up again what the podcast is supposed to be about, this is Heroic Beasts is intended as an appreciation, a love letter basically, to this medium of comic books and how instrumental it was for me and others my age, as kids back in the 70s and 80s, being introduced to the world, the genre of anthropomorphic animals. Now, of course, every kid knows Disney and Warner Brothers cartoons, which are awesome, just like they know fables and fairy tales with talking animals. So it's not like comics were the first time we heard of the concept, but comics were kind of different. Comics had those kid-friendly characters as well, but they also had this more kind of for adults stuff in the mainstream. Not like adult, but like, you know, like comic books, like Superman, Batman, stuff like that. They also had like really off the wall shit you would never see in a Disney cartoon. Cartoons were safe, and like comics, independent comics were underground, fringe. Comics were counterculture. Independent comics are literally where the furry fandom started. And while I personally baby-stepped my way into that stuff by buying issues of like Captain Carrot and his amazing Zoo Crew and X-Men because I like the Beast and stuff like that, eventually I got there. And comics were instrumental in showing me that anthropomorphic animals didn't have to be like just for kids. They weren't just for telling kids stories. So if you're returning for this second episode, thank you. Hopefully this one will be at least a little step up from last time. I've learned some things, gotten some tips and tricks from friends who are much better at this sort of thing than I am. And frankly, this episode we have a much better comic to talk about. The Incredible Hulk number 271. The canonical, not technical, but canonical first appearance of one Mr. Rocket Raccoon. Hi, buddy. That is my cat, Dusty. He is very needy. But before we get into this episode's issue, let's settle in. Let's chat. We never just talk anymore, you and I. I thought it might be fun at the top of the show to start things off by talking about some current comics being published right now, featuring anthro characters that people might be interested in checking out. You know, a chance to get out there and support some current artists and projects. So, welcome to this new segment I'm going to call The Bunny Bipile. So, first up, from DC Comics, a new four-part miniseries called The New Champion of Shazam. The first issue's out. The second issue is yet to be released at the time I'm talking here. And just to give sort of like a background of what this comic is, DC has done multiple reboots to their universe, like the continuity of their universe in the last 15 years or so. I think they've done at least 2, it might be 3. I don't know. I don't follow DC very closely. We'll stick to DC's current continuity for this story setup. Billy Batson is the original champion of Shazam. He's a kid who says a magic word and becomes an adult superhero. That's his deal. Mary Bromfield is his foster sister and the lead character of this series. Billy shared the power of Shazam with Mary and their 4 other foster siblings until recently, when some emergency forced Billy to exile himself to another reality. I don't know exactly what this was about, but this is the setup of the story, and took the power of Shazam with him. So his foster siblings no longer have the power of Shazam. That's the Shazam setup. And the story begins with Mary, now free from superhero responsibilities, heading off to college. But shortly after arriving at college, Mary receives a message from Billy telling her there is great danger and Shazam needs a new champion on Earth. And guess what, lady? It's you. Which brings us to the reason I'm mentioning this series in the Bipile. Billy delivers this message to Mary using his powers across realities to enchant Mary's dorm roommate's pet bunny, Hoppy. So Hoppy the bunny is talking to Mary, being her little Jiminy Cricket, telling her to go be a superhero. and Hoppy has powers of his own, because Mary's reluctant. She's like, oh, I'm done with that shit. I'm going to college. Hoppy has powers of his own to help push Mary in the right direction. Seems like besides talking, he's a teleporter. And at one point in the issue, he takes Mary to where some guy is pulling off a robbery to get her to Shazam it up. Now, it might seem kind of random talking bunny in this superhero story, but this is writer Josie Campbell referencing a character that has been around almost as long as the original Fawcett comics Shazam, Captain Marvel, Hoppy the Marvel Bunny. Hoppy was a funny animal version of Captain Marvel. These were stories for younger kids, kind of like Spider-Ham was originally for Spider-Man. But now they're bringing the character into the standard continuity, and I thought it was pretty cute. Seems like Hoppy will play a significant supporting role in the series, at least this series, possibly into the future with Mary and the Shazam family. The art in the issue is from Evan Doc Shaner. It's pretty great. He looks looks like a pencil style or a pencil with no ink style. But the pencils are very tight and clean. He draws a pretty great bunny, too. New Champion of Shazam is available in comic stores. Pretty much anywhere you can go. It's a DC series, so it's going to be everywhere. You can also get it digitally through Amazon Kindle Comixology. Next item on the buy pile. Samurai Doggy number 1 from Aftershock Comics. Samurai Doggy is a smaller press type comic, but certainly doesn't lack in production value. It's created by the Brazilian duo of writer Chris Tex and artist Santos. Samurai Doggy is the story of a lone canine samurai and his robo-vulture buddy in a post-apocalyptic land full of mutated animals and robots. Doggy is on a quest to track down the entity who killed his mother and kidnapped all of his siblings when he was just a puppy. That's hard to judge the story after just one issue, but I found the art pretty neat in this first issue. Artist Santos describes his approach as a little bit anime, a little bit cinema, with influences of traditional Japanese art and Brazilian street art. It's a pretty unique look. And as something in a full-on anthropomorphic setting, this is the impression you get is this is post-apocalyptic. They've dropped the nukes, animals have mutated, and there's robots that have also survived the apocalypse. There's no people, just animal people and robots. You might be able to find this comic in comic stores, but being smaller press, it's something that may need to be special ordered. Alternately, you can also order copies via Aftershock's website, aftershockcomics.com, or, again, digitally through Amazon Kindle Comixology. And that is it for the buy pile this episode. So without further ado, let's get to our boy, Rocket Raccoon. In the last episode, we covered Rocket's first credited appearance in Marvel Preview number 7, but that was very much a proto-Rocket, a first stab at the character Rocket would become. And in a way, this issue is too, but you're going to see a lot more familiar tropes this time around. Hulk number 271 is where Rocket really begins his journey in the Marvel Universe. I can't wait to dig in, so let's get going. Incredible Hulk number 271. The cover price was 60 cents, and this issue had a release date of January 8th, 1982. Welcome to the 80s, Rocket Raccoon. Let's get all of us acclimated to the 80s. Let's lay down some historical context. What else was swimming around in people's heads in February of 1982, besides cocaine and Reaganomics? The number one movie in theaters this week, at the week that this comic was released, On Golden Pond, starring Katharine Hepburn, Henry Fonda, and Jane Fonda. And I think that was kind of like a gimmick where they had Henry Fonda and Jane Fonda, father and daughter in real life, playing father and daughter in the movie. Number one song in the Billboard charts, Centerfold by the J. Giles Band. I kind of laughed at this. I was like, Centerfold was the number one song? Number one show on TV, Dallas. Yes, this was the era of the primetime soap opera. And what was in the news? Not a whole lot, but just a couple weeks back, on January 20th, a rock history legend occurred. Ozzy Osbourne, allegedly, bit the head off a live bat on stage in Des Moines, Iowa. Since then, it's widely acknowledged that the bat was actually dead at the time, but it was still a bat, like a real fucking bat, that he bit the head off of. And either way, Ozzy took it to the bank. That's part of his legacy. Yeah, that's what was going on when you were on your way to buy this comic. Those are the things that you were thinking about. Being a good 80s person. So let's go through the creative team for this issue. Writer, once again, Bill Mantlow. So Mantlow wrote the original. Mantlow is really the main creative force behind Rocket Raccoon as the writer. And quick Mantlow fact number two. Two of Bill Mantlow's most celebrated comic runs in his career were The Micronauts and Rom Space Knight, both licensed series for Marvel Comics, and both of these comic series were far more popular and longer living than the very short-lived toys they were based on. So Mantlow took shitty toys and turned them into great comics, basically. And he's kind of like, that's one of the things he's famous for, besides Rocket Raccoon and Cloak and Dagger. Pencils and inks, Sal Buscema. Quick Sal Buscema fact. Sal had a whopping 10-year run as an artist on The Incredible Hulk, which is his self-professed favorite comic character. He's also the younger brother of legendary comic artist John Buscema. Not to say that Sal isn't legendary, too. They're both legendary. Colors, Bob Sharon. Quick Bob Sharon fact. Bob Sharon worked as a comic colorist for 24 years, but retired from the industry in 2001 to open a custom glass shop called Earthlight Studios. So if you need any stained glass windows, give Bob Sharon a call. Letters, Jim Novak. Quick Jim Novak fact. Jim Novak, who had a prolific lettering career with Marvel, is often credited with creating the famous Star Wars logo. But it's not exactly accurate. Jim did create a version of the Star Wars logo, but Jim's version, which removed the ligatures that usually blend together the S and T in Star and the R and S in Wars, ligatures being that, like, how the S is connected to the T and the R kind of swoops over into the last S in Wars. He took those out and separated the letters. And his version was only used on the first two issues of Marvel's Star Wars comic series. So technically, yes, Jim Novak created a Star Wars logo, but not the Star Wars logo. Editor, Al Milgram. Quick Al Milgram fact. Al Milgram worked for Marvel Comics as a writer, penciler, editor, and probably best known for being an inker from the mid-70s all the way up till 2001, when he was fired when someone noticed he had hidden slanderous comments in the background of a comic about Marvel's recently dismissed editor-in-chief Bob Harris while inking the issue Universe X Special Spidey. And I looked it up. The message he put in there was something to the effect of, like, haha, Bob Harris is gone. No one will miss him. He was a mean SOB or something like that. He wrote that on, like, some books on a shelf. Someone noticed and they canned his ass because it's libel or slander or something like that. I don't know. Editor-in-chief, Jim Shooter. Quick Jim Shooter fact. Jim Shooter, kind of a infamous figure in comics history, but Jim got his break in the comic business writing Legion of Superhero scripts at age 14. He originally, when he was 13, he sent in a bunch of, like, scripts with some art to the DC offices, and they sent him back, and they were just like, hey, you know, these aren't bad, but work on this stuff. And he sent them back in when he was 14 with, like, better versions of them. And, got a job. And he wrote Legion of Superheroes and I think some Superboy stories for a few years before he retired to, I think, finish high school. So that's our creative team for this issue. Let's get into the action. So, obviously, this is an issue of The Incredible Hulk, which also just so happens to be the Hulk's 20th anniversary issue. as he makes reference to on the cover. So the Hulk had been around for a while at this time. He's a very well-established pop culture iconic character. In fact, it's arguable that the Hulk was the most prominent comic book character in pop culture at this time, because the live-action Hulk TV show was on its fifth and final season, so the Hulk was a household name. So his exposure goes, like, the Hulk, this is probably one of the best-selling comics, the Incredible Hulk, at this time in the comics industry. So it's pretty good exposure. Rocket really couldn't have asked for a much more high-profile arrival on the scene in the Marvel Universe. So yeah, speaking of the cover artist was Al Milgrom, also our editor, the guy who was fired. And by the way, Al continued working. He just lost his staff job at Marvel. He still worked for Marvel and DC and lots of other places. They just couldn't keep him on staff. Yeah, Al Milgrom gives us our first official look at Rocket Raccoon in the Marvel Universe and Marvel continuity proper. Al's version of Rocket here in the cover, he's wearing a little silver vest with a chest-mounted pouch. He's got a Goldfish Bowl Flash Gordon helmet there with a little antenna on the side. His rocket skates with little booster rockets coming out of them to fly him through space. And an odd extra touch just here on the cover, yellow gloves on his four-fingered hands. Rocket's five-fingered inside the issue. I think other than when like he's drawn in very cartoony fashion, he almost always has five fingers, I believe. And yeah, the yellow gloves are weird because they don't even match anything. I don't know why the colorist made them yellow. But there he is. And the Hulk is pissed off. He's like, what? Hulk has to share his 20th anniversary issue with puny talking animal? And Rocket is saying, you got it, Jade Jaws. Move over and make way for Rocket Raccoon. It's a kind of tongue-in-cheek kind of intro to the issue. And it sort of gets us set up for if you're a Hulk fan who's used to reading the Hulk's normal stories, it kind of gets you set up for like, okay, this isn't going to be business as usual. This is a little different. On to page one. It's a splash page, but almost half the page is taken up by the title, which reads, now somewhere in the black holes of Sirius Major, there lived a young boy named of Rocket Raccoon. So right from the get-go, Mantlow is cluing us into his little in-joke. He's not trying to be subtle about it. He wants everyone to know we're having some fun with this. The title to this issue is, of course, a reference to the Beatles song Rocky Raccoon, written by Paul McCartney in 1968 and released as part of the Beatles' White Album. Of course, this song was the impetus for the creation of Rocket Raccoon and the abstracted origins of a few of Rocket's early story elements. And the first line in the song Rocky Raccoon is, now somewhere in the Black Mountain Hills of Dakota there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. Which is what the title is riffing off of. And the song Rocky Raccoon, by the way, is not a raccoon. I referred to the song a little bit in the last episode, but I just kind of assumed that everyone knew the Beatles song. The song details his plan to get revenge on the man who stole his girl, basically. McCartney's original title for the song was actually Rocky Sassoon. But he changed the character's name to Rocky Raccoon before he finalized the song because he thought that it made the character sound, quote, more like a cowboy. Which is kind of wild to me. Because if McCartney hadn't decided to make that change, hadn't been high on whatever the fuck mountains of drugs the Beatles were on back in those days, and thought that Raccoon sounded like a cowboy name, who knows if Bill Mantlow, he wouldn't have heard the song. He would have heard the song Rocky Sassoon, and had it not been Rocky Raccoon, he probably wouldn't have heard the song while he was high and come up with the idea, like, dude, what if Rocky Raccoon were a raccoon? They might not be selling clip-on raccoon tails at Disneyland. So tip of the hat to Mr. McCartney and his odd understanding of cowboy names. But here we see on page one here, back to the comic, my digression. We see the Hulk. Hulk's face, close up on the Hulk's face, looking sound asleep on a field of red grass, and he's got what look like two guns pointed at him from unseen figures off panel. And on to page two, and here we see our first look at the raccoon himself. Sal Buscema's version of the character is appears to be mostly naked, giant pouch on his chest. Once again, Bill Mantlo must have just had a fucking thing for pouches on the chest. Is he like every version of Rocket? He's got Milgram's version on the cover, the Sword in the Star version of Rocky Raccoon, and this version. They've all got these chest-mounted pouches, which are just awkward as shit. It really seems like it can't be an artist's idea to put this here. It's got to be the writer not thinking visually. Just like, he's got the pouch because it makes sense for the reasons I've made up in my mind. It's it really ruins the silhouette of the character. I don't know. Okay, again, I'm digressing here. He's got this pouch in his chest. He's got a little blue cape or cowl. He's got a blaster in his paw. And most interestingly, appears to be smoking a techno version of like a corncob pipe. Which is a strange choice. Maybe to give him a Black Mountain Hills of Dakota vibe, like the song refers to Rocky Raccoon as being from. Also on this page, we're on this first panel, we see Walrus. Hi, Dusty. Yeah, hi. Okay, also on this panel, we've got Walrus, which seems likely to be another Beatles reference if you're in any way familiar with the Beatles. This is the song I Am the Walrus. Was written by John Lennon, supposedly during a pair of acid trips, and was part of the Magical Mystery Tour album in 1967. Incidentally, the video for the song includes the Beatles doing their thing, just singing and dancing around in animal masks, with John wearing a full walrus costume. I think it's John. Walrus here in the comic appears to be a standard walrus, doesn't seem to have any alterations or mutations or cybernetic parts or anything like that to make him more bipedal or anything. But he's got a chest-mounted pouch as well, once again. But out of his pouch, he's got a couple of little snaky robot Dr. Octopus arms coming out, brandishing his weapon and a scanner. He's scanning the Hulk with it. He's wearing some kind of brown, jumpsuit. What do you call it if it's on a walrus? They don't do a lot of jumping. And he's got one normal tusk in his mouth, and in the place of the other tusk is some sort of techno wrench-looking thing. So he's got, he's, I guess he I lied, he does have some cybernetic parts here. And on this page, Rocket and Wall are here standing over the sleeping Hulk. On this field of red grass, we see pink vegetation, trees and such behind them. The sky is all yellow, so we know we're on an alien world. Rocket is asking Wall, is he one of Judson Jake's automaton assassins? But Wall is saying, no, he's alive. And he's also bursting with gamma radiation. And here in the next panel, we got onomatopoeia of snickersnack, snickersnack, building throughout the page. Sound effects. And Rocket and Wall know this is bad news as they rush to try to move the unconscious Hulk out of the path of danger. In the final panel, we see the Robomower is here, as we see this sort of lawnmower tank robot with bladed appendages and a kind of robot head on top, heading right at our heroes and the unconscious Hulk. On to page three, Rocket fires up his little silver rocket skates and flies off toward the Robomower to try to divert it away from the helpless Hulk. And Rocket's saying, eat hot light, robot! Rocket is just zipping around on his rocket skates, firing at the Robomower, but having no effect. So Rocket heads back to Walrus and tells him they gotta hightail it, but realizes that their mysterious unconscious visitor is now missing. But on this page here, we get a better look at Rocket. First, we get a clear look at his rocket skates and how they work, and we also get a few back views of him. He's lost his Roman armor skirt. Now he's got kind of a tight metal loincloth with a belt and suspenders. It's not Rocket's strongest look, I would say. But I do like his little blue cape or serape or whatever you call it. It's a cute touch. Some great panels of Rocket here in this page flying around. Buscema's Anthro style isn't going to knock anyone's socks off, but he's got some great silhouettes in Rocket's posing here and some good clear expressions. Like he took this seriously. He did not phone it in. And I think the art really looks like he enjoyed himself with the issue. It's probably, hopefully, a fun departure for him from the usual Hulk fare this issue. On to the next page, page four. Along with Rocket and Wall, we look on to see Hulk doing his thing, smashing the shit out of the Robo Mower. Pretty much exactly the kind of thing you want to see Hulk doing if you're a Hulk fan. Rocket and Walrus look on, just totally amazed, as the Hulk is taking out this heretofore invincible hazard for them without even breaking a sweat. On to page five. So the Robo Mower is destroyed. The Hulk is returning to Rocket and Wall. He wants to know what the hell is going on, where is he, who are these funny talking animals. At this stage in Hulk comics, Hulk is dumb Hulk, very childlike, his very simple desires, and easily frustrated into a rage. Rocket is responding to the Hulk, saying he was about to ask the Hulk the same thing, but Walrus interrupts, telling them they gotta get scarce because he just picked up trouble on the fuzz detector. Hulk says he's not afraid of the police, but Walrus explains, "Neither are we, Hulk. It's just that we have much to do and little time to waste when it comes to the Keystone Quadrant cops." And speak of the devil, on panel four, we're introduced to the Keystone Quadrant cops. They arrive in some kind of huge oversized green jalopy, which they crash into the broken Robo Mower, and all the cops go flying out of the vehicle. Very slapstick-like, as they all yell absurd stuff about arresting the Robo Mower for interfering with the course of justice. The Keystone Quadrant cops are, of course, a reference to the Keystone Cops, a group of characters that appeared in a bunch of slapstick silent films in the 1910s, from 1912 to 1917, I believe, with guys like Charlie Chaplin and Fatty Arbuckle, big film stars at the time. The cops were kind of like a recurring element that would just appear in lots of different films. Their shtick was basically that they were goofy and incompetent in funny ways. Lots of fast motion chases and falling down and getting stuck in doorways and whatnot. I know, right? Incompetent police? Crazy! That's crazy. So, in referring to the cops, this page is the first time we hear the reference to the Keystone Quadrant, because they're the Keystone Quadrant cops. And then on the last couple panels, it's also the first time we see or hear the name of Rocket's ship, the Rack and Ruin. Page six. So our crew has made it on board the Rack and Ruin. We get a little back and forth here from Rocket and Wall, a little good-natured bickering, letting us know Rocket has a girlfriend named Lila, who is also Walrus's niece. And that's our first mention of Lila, Rocket's girlfriend. Also, presumably, a reference to the Beatles' Rocky Raccoon song, which says about Rocky's girl, her name was McGill. She called herself Lil, but everyone knew her as Nancy. So, Lil, Lila, it's pretty close. It's Rocket's girlfriend. It seems like it would be a reference. Walrus gets the Rack and Ruin flying, and they take off while the Keystone Quadrant cops are still going nuts. While Wall is flying, Rocket gets the Hulk some food and gives him the lowdown, tells him they don't know how he got to their world, but that now he's on Half-World, the largest planet in the star system known as the Keystone Quadrant. And he shows the Hulk a view screen of a world that's surrounded by a wall, kind of like a ring around Saturn, except it's like a wall. So I like this part here where on this page where Rocket is giving the Hulk his food. He goes over to a panel in the ship with a sign that says food and stuff and hits a yellow button, and the ship just spits out a bunch of like, there's like a ham and a turkey or a chicken or something and some sausages and then a bunch of fruit, which is smart. I think you need that fruit in there for the fiber. You wouldn't just want to just be eating meat all day. I wouldn't want to see what a constipated walrus could do to your space toilet. This is on this page, we get our first mention of Half-World, though. and our first sort of half look at it, we'd see a little bit of it on the page here. Mostly we're looking at that wall. But yeah, these are elements of sort of Rocket's early history that are shown up for the first time here in this issue. Page 7. So we get a lot of exposition on this page. Rocket is explaining the story of his world. He starts off by telling the Hulk no one knows where this big wall around the system called the Galatian Wall came from, but it's always been there as far as they know. He then gives Hulk some background on Half-World, the planet where Hulk woke up. He's saying, why is it called Half-World, you ask? Because half of it is stripped bare, an industrial wasteland where automatons labor, as they've labored forever, on a giant humanoid spacecraft known as Ship. And we see a bunch of robots here working on a giant, like, robot head, like celestial-sized robot head. Rocket goes on, the other half is a paradise planet where we have animals play and farm with machines the automatons gave us because they can't help making them and can't use them once they do. The ship the robots are making on this page here, not to be confused with Ship from the X-Factor comics, as they used for a base for a while, no relation. Also in this explanation, there is no mention of scientists, genetic engineering, no mention of the loonies, all aspects that pop up in the Rocket miniseries that comes out in 85. So far, the only humans on the planet, according to Walrus, are the Keystone Cops. So still backstory and development here in this issue of the Hulk. So this is another packed page here, page 8. Here Rocket starts off giving Hulk the lowdown on a murderous mole named Judson Jakes. Rocket tells us Jakes lives on board the Space Wheel in the center of the quadrant. No one knows what he's up to, but he runs a company called Interstell Mechanics. So here we get our first mention and look at Judson Jakes, and I had to comment, this is the one animal design that I think Sal Buscema really nails. He's this little blocky, beady-eyed mole in a robe, which colorist Bob Sharon picks a cool color combo for, red and white on the robe, and then like a blue crest. His little mole nose is sticking out over the robe's collar. He's got these huge digging claws. He's just a very cool, striking little evil, cute character. In the Rocket Raccoon miniseries, as I mentioned in 85, the penciler, Mike Mignola, redesigns most of the characters and, frankly, improves them significantly. But Judson Jakes is the one character that Mignola doesn't touch. He basically looks exactly the same here as he does in the Mignola series, and I don't think it's surprising. Mignola probably saw it and was like, I can't make it better. He's awesome. We're also introduced to Uncle Pico here, the turtle, the head scientist for Interstell Mechanics, who makes automaton assassins like the Killer Clowns and the Dracolars. He's a pretty hefty-looking turtle, but he's wearing spectacles to let you know he's old and or smart. And it looks like his tailor is Jack Kirby. His shell looks very New Gods. The Killer Clowns that they refer to here, not a reference to the movie. This was 1982, and Killer Clowns, the movie, came out in 88, so no relation. Also mentioned are the Black Bunny Brigade, a group of renegade rabbits that work for Jakes and do his dirty work. And we see one of the bunnies here, an anthro black rabbit with a gun and armor, or maybe some cybernetics, I don't know. Rocket goes on to say Jakes is after a book called Gideon's Bible, which is said to contain the origins of the Keystone Quadrant, but is written in a language no one can read. And this is yet another reference to the Beatles song Rocky Raccoon. When Rocky Raccoon checks into his room before the showdown, the only thing he can find in the room is Gideon's Bible. It's referenced a few times in the song, so they folded it into the story here. But just then, Walrus says they're getting an emergency alert from Lila. And on the view screen, we see Lila on the monitor saying the Black Bunny Brigade has attacked the Cuckoo's Nest. And here's the Black Bunny Brigade behind her shooting up the place and killing some poor pig guy. So after seeing this, Rocket asks for the Hulk's help. The Hulk is hesitant. He's been through some crazy shit lately in the last few issues, and he just wants to go home to Rick and Betty. So we also get our first look at Lila on this page. She looks not great. She kind of looks like one of those taxidermy fails here. But I'm going to save Lila talk until we get a better look at her in another page. Now, pages 9 through 10. We're going to glaze over these pages. No offense to Hulk fans. I mean, the Hulk's entitled to a few pages in his own anniversary issue devoted to his own stories, but this is mostly just a check-in with the aftermath of the previous issue's storylines for Betty and Rick, and teases what's to come next in the Hulk mag, all related to the Hulk's own ongoing story and have nothing to do with Rocket, so moving on. Page 11, back to the Keystone Quadrant. The crew arrives at the Cuckoo's Nest to help Lila and find chaos, smoking buildings and bodies everywhere. However, the narration box assures us these are silent, unconscious animals strewn about. So, not dead bodies. Thanks, Jim Shooter. Rocket finds one animal still conscious. Quote, it's his old pal, Stinker the Skunk. Basically, he looks like Pepe Le Pew wearing yellow metal lederhosen. Stinker tells Rocket the Black Bunny Brigade kidnapped Lila and took Gideon's Bible. Wall asks, taken where? And Rocket responds in the final panel, only one place, Wall, to Space Wheel and to Judson Jakes. And the narration box tells us, murder darkens Rocket Raccoon's eyes. And by murder, of course, they mean inflicting silent unconsciousness. I love this last panel of Rocket. It's just like, he's like, I'm going to mess you up. Like, he's fucking pissed. It's pretty funny. But as funny as Rocket's eyes filled with murder are, I think my favorite thing in this panel is how completely disinterested the Hulk is. He's just looking off some other direction. Like, yeah, your friend is dying in your arms. Your girlfriend is kidnapped. Cool, man. Whatever. He just seems like the Hulk is like, in the previous issue, I think he was fighting some like alien god or something like that. And he wakes up on this planet and I think he's just done. He's just like, okay, fucking talking animals, whatever. Also Stinker. I just found that funny. Like skunk named Stinker. Page 12, Space Wheel, headquarters of the sinister Judson Jakes. Most of this page is concerned with Jake's telling Uncle Pyko to get Kraken deciphering the Gideon's Bible, which has been delivered to him by the Black Bunny Brigade. Uncle Pyko is quick to dismiss it as practically impossible, saying, funny letters, incomprehensible alphabet, a gobbledygook of grammatical errors. But you get the impression he's hiding something. It's like if the alphabet were incomprehensible, how could he know there were grammatical errors? So clearly we know Uncle Pyko is a sneaky bastard. Pyko also smoking, by the way, got a cigar. Meanwhile, the first time on this page we get the name Blackjack O'Hare, leader of the Black Bunny Brigade. Blackjack is holding Lila prisoner on the bridge here while telling Pyko he should stop complaining because the Black Bunny Brigade does all the hard work. I've seen it speculated that Blackjack O'Hare is a reference to Bucky O'Hare, but Bucky debuted in comics in May of 1984, and this issue of the Hulk is from 1982, so unlikely. And in the last panel, a Dracolar shows up to let Judson Jakes know that Rocket Raccoon has arrived. Yeah, we get this peek at the Dracolar here, which I have some thoughts about, but I'm going to save that until we get a little better look at him later. We do, however, get a better look at Lila on this page. Being held captive by Blackjack O'Hare, we see her full body, and we also get a close-up of her face in the last panel. Now, Lila is an otter. She's even referred to as an otter in this issue, but it has to be said, she looks absolutely nothing like an otter. Like, not even slightly. She kind of looks like a weasel, maybe? Maybe somewhere between a weasel and a fox? Yeah, there's nothing even slightly otter-like about her. So you might wonder, like, reading this book and being like, that's supposed to be an otter? How does this happen? This is a professional comic artist. Before you give Sal Buscema too hard a time, don't forget, this is 1982. There is no internet. If you needed reference of an otter and you didn't have a book in your home with a picture of an otter in it, you were pretty much shit out of luck. And you might say, well, you could go to the library and check out a book on otters. Sal was penciling and inking this book himself. A comic is 22 pages, and he's got 1 month to get it done. But wait, there's more. He was also doing a second monthly book at the same time, ROM Space Knight. So he was doing 44 pages of pencils and inks every month, not to mention he was a father of three. So the idea of taking time out of his day to go to the library to get reference for one minor character in his hippie writer's silly little one-off talking animal story, I don't think he'd consider it for very long. So old Sal gave it his best shot. Didn't sweat the details, man. And who can blame the guy? But don't worry, Lila. You're going to be looking better come the miniseries. Page 13. Rocket is coming, so Pyko and Judson talk about, quote, sending in the clowns. Rocket and crew arrive at the space wheel, and we get this exchange between Rocket and Wall. Rocket, there she blows, Wall. Judson Jake's murder go round. Walrus, I know, I piloted us here. Rocket, so what do you want, a medal? I'm the one who's got to blast in and get Lila out. I thought the exchange was kind of fun. Sort of shades of future Rocket and his, like, attitude here. The Hulk says he's decided to help, which Rocket is glad to hear, because here come the clowns. Through space in the final panel, we see a gaggle of clowns coming out of the space wheel, flying with rocket skates, riding beach balls, juggling mines. You know, standard space clown stuff. I love this narration on the introduction of the clowns. Cyborg assassins, they skip across space on silent rocket skates, their gay garb betokening not merriment, but murder. I need to remember to figure out what my gay garb betokens. And over these pages, this page and the next couple pages, we get a bit of a sense of Blackjack O'Hare, who after Rocket is probably the most mainstream addition to the Marvel Universe from the story. He's been used in other series. He was used in one of the more recent Guardians of the Galaxy books and in Rocket's own series. For our first look at him, we pretty much see that he's this sort of the standard space pirate mercenary archetype. He's gruff, suspicious, cutthroat, probably not the brightest. There's some lightly implied misogyny. But that's about all we really get from him as a personality in this Hulk issue. Page 14, the clowns are now attacking the Rack and Ruin. Rocket helps the Hulk gear up with his own Flash Gordon fishbowl helmet, and out they go into space to fight some clowns. Rocket wastes no time, blasts a hole in one of them right away. Page 15. And here we go, Hulk fans. Enough talking animals. Hulk smash clowns. The Hulk throws one punch and has somehow hit at least six clowns, and they all go flying. And that's why they pay him the big Hulk bucks, folks. A clown tries to sneak up on the Hulk from behind, but Rocket takes him out, and Hulk compliments Rocket's shooting. The last panel of the page, the Hulk sees something and calls out a dire and oddly grammatically correct warning to Rocket. Look out, there is another clown behind you. And the Hulk was right. A clown ambushes Rocket from behind and grabs his pistol hand and starts burning through his space helmet with laser eyes. And Rocket starts freaking out, yelling, Jeeps, laser contact lenses trying to open up my helmet. Help! Luckily, Hulk arrives and tosses the clown off into space. I found Rocket's line kind of funny. Rocket has specified that the lasers are from special laser contact lenses. But this explanation seems sort of unnecessary when we already know the clown is a cyborg and could presumably just be built with laser eyes, so I don't know. Also, how is the Hulk moving around in space? He has no means of propulsion, but he gets right over to Rocket when he needs to. I guess don't think about it. It's a comic. And with that last clown defeated, now Rocket and Hulk turn their attention to the space wheel. But how are they going to get in? Now, the Hulk has a strategy in mind to get into Space Wheel. He posits that by accessing an airlock maintenance panel, they can overload the release circuit by rerouting power from its stabilizing thrusters through the reserve plasma conduits. I'm kidding. His plan is punching. He punches through the station wall here on page 17. Parak. And he and Rocket both enter the space station. Hulk asks Rocket where they're going. Rocket says he doesn't know. I've always been sort of ferra non grata aboard space wheel. So I guess they have Latin on half world. Rocket and Hulk encounter Blackjack O'Hare in the hallway with Lila held captive at gunpoint. And I love this panel here, panel 4 on this page. We see Hulk and Rocket coming around the corner, but we're looking through Blackjack's legs. It's given us a little Mr. O'Hare, are you trying to seduce me graduate style reveal here, which I thought was fun. Blackjack threatens Lila and tells Rocket to drop his guns or he'll blast her. So Rocket does as he's told. He can't risk Lila being hurt. But the Hulk has another intricate plan. You guessed it, it's punching. He punches the ground. Wham! Page 18. The physics seem questionable for this on a space station, but the Hulk's ground pound sends an earthquake shockwave down the hall that knocks Blackjack for a loop without touching Lila. The Hulk wields an earthquake like a surgeon. Rocket then punches out Blackjack with a Spock. Spock! So reunited, Rocket and Lila run off to find Gideon's Bible. The Hulk begins to follow, but the Hulk is easily distracted, and he sees a flash of light and goes off on his own into this room. He's like, wow, a light? You gotta find out what that's about. Where he finds Uncle Pyko, and Uncle Pyko is showing the Hulk a picture of Earth on a view screen. Pyko tells Hulk he can send him home. So obviously, Pyko doesn't want this wild card, the Hulk, messing with this setup he has going on here. It's got to get rid of the Hulk. And at page 19, back to Rocket and Lila. They arrive on the bridge, or wherever this is, wherever Judson's hanging out, and confronts Judson Jakes. But Jakes sicks his Dracular on Rocket. Rocket says this creature used to be a harmless little bat. But I have no fucking idea where he's getting bat from with this thing. It's called a Dracular, so it sounds like a Dracula reference, so a bat would make sense. But this thing looks like a green sheet with blender blades for feet and a squid head in a Magneto helmet. I give Sal Buscema a pass on Lila. Not knowing what an otter looks like is one thing, but what the fuck is this? This is the goofiest looking thing I've ever seen. But it hardly matters anyway. Rocket takes it out quick. Rocket figured out the Dracular's one weakness, being shot directly in the face at point blank range. How did he know? So Rocket grabs Judson, says, give me the book or I'll blast out the window. Send you flying off into space. Judson oddly seems less concerned about being sucked into space and killed and more concerned with don't damage space wheel. So it seems like he needs to re-examine his priorities. Page 20. Back in Pyko's lab, the turtle is convincing the Hulk to let him send him home. Pyko also reveals he's been lying and could read Gideon's Bible by probing a Keystone Cop's brain, which killed him, and finding out that the cops are descendants of the first comers who wrote the Bible, and says the Hulk is also a descendant of the first comers. So we know that whoever the first comers were humans, apparently. But the Hulk, he's not interested in any of that shit. The Hulk just agrees. He says, send me home. So the Hulk's just like, he's just done. Like, fuck this goofy shit, man. He's just like Irish goodbyes the whole affair. Fuck you and the fate of your world, I guess, Rocket. I'm going home. he's had a rough run, I think. He's been off Earth for a while, I think. Yeah, there's been a few adventures in space before this one, so we won't give him too hard a time. Page 21. Pyko shows up on the bridge and hands over Gideon Bible to Rocket, still claiming that he was never able to understand it. Pyko lets Rocket know that the Hulk is going home, but lies and tells him that whatever brought him there must have worn off. And we see the Hulk zip by in space. It's like a comet that goes by with like a green blur in it. But Rocket and Lila grab the book and split. And then on page 22, last page of the book, we see Pyko double down on lying to his supposed boss about Gideon's Bible, even though all the heroes have gone. So clearly Pyko has his own agenda. And we check in one last time with Rocket, Walrus, and Lila on the Rack and Ruin. They're worried about the Hulk. They're hoping that they cross paths again someday. In the final panel, we see the Hulk rocketing through space like a comet, which seems to be pretty goofy. But hey, it fits with the tone of the issue, I suppose. And in this last panel of Rocket, we see he's busted out his space corncob pipe again. You know, because smoking. Cute animals love it, kids. Shouldn't you? And there you have it. The end of The Incredible Hulk number 271 and Rocket Raccoon's introduction to the Marvel Universe proper. And by proper, I mean in normal Marvel continuity, not in an alternate world or timeline or anything like that. But this issue of The Hulk in 1982 really sets the stage, establishes a lot of Rocket's backstory, and while it's been changed around here and there over the years, Mantlo gets the broad strokes down here. Rocket is an adventurer, he's a leader and protector of the animals on Half-World, he's a little brash, courageous, he's very comfortable in space, he's a great shot, he's a hero. Much different approach than Sword in the Star, and all I think most would agree for the better. But how did this first appearance of Rocket go over with fans at the time? It's kind of hard to know for sure, but we do have a little bit of context on it, because we can skip ahead a few issues and read the letters page of Incredible Hulk number 276, where people have written in reacting to the issue and given their thoughts. So I decided I'm going to pick three letters and read them out here. Letter number one. Dear all, last month I noticed that the Incredible Hulk number 271 would feature something called Rocket Raccoon, and frankly, I was worried. I've seen a different company's menagerie of super animals, written by a once rascally writer, and it's pretty bad. Cute animals with cute names and cute costumes make for a cute comic. I don't like cute. What was I supposed to think when you announced yet another one? I shouldn't have worried. How could something inspired by a Beatles song go wrong? And when Mantlo pulls out all the stops trying to be funny, he is very funny indeed. From Walrus's cyborg can opener tusk to Greek, what's Greek? My enjoyment-o-meter was on continuous chuckle. The Greek part is a reference to a line from Judson Jakes when Pyko mistakenly says the book is all Greek to me. Thank you for Hulk number 271. Thanks also for daring to do something different with a 20th anniversary issue. Phil Jones, Starkville, Mississippi. So a pretty positive letter, although I'm not sure what menagerie of super animals from DC Comics he's talking about. At first I assumed he meant Captain Carrot, but Captain Carrot made his first appearance like at the very same time as this issue, February 1982. So he couldn't have read it before Hulk 271. So if there is some other menagerie of super animals out there from DC that predates this Hulk comic, it's news to me. I would love to find out what it is. If anybody knows, let me know. Letter 2. Formerly Dear Marvel. So when did six-year-olds join the bullpen staff? The Incredible Hulk number 271 reeked. Are you all regressing back to your childhoods? The appearance of Barit and her toys was dumb enough. Those are the pages I skipped. But devoting the Hulk's 20th anniversary issue to somebody's stuffed toys come to life reflects severe psychological problems. Here's to The Incredible Hulk number 271, a comic that will live in infamy. Nuke Sirius Major. Ken Ward, Emil Rodrigue, Bill Dunn, John Petrie, Adam Thibault, from Hancock Hall, University of Maine, Orono, Maine. So it seems like these five guys must have been in a comic book club or something together in college, which, hey, is cool with my, you know, it's cool with me. But I guess they all got together and agreed with each other that talking animals, silly. They preferred more sophisticated, mature literature about huge green muscle men punching things. And they must have put pen to paper post-haste and let their collective harumph be heard. Don't let them get you down, Rocket. Haters gonna hate. Letter 3. Dear Marvel, The Incredible Hulk number 271 was perhaps the best issue of any comic I ever read. I really enjoyed Rocket Raccoon and Walrus. They kind of reminded me of a Wild Kingdom Han Solo and Chewbacca. I'd love to see more of them both, perhaps starring in their own comic mag. If Rocket Raccoon number 1 were to come out tomorrow, I would rush to buy it. Finally, congratulations on the Hulk's 20th year in comics. I've been reading his mag for years and loving it. Thanks for listening, and make mine Marvel. Michael Britt, Zebulon, Georgia. There's a place in Georgia called Zebulon? That's just a cool name. So it seems like Rocket went over pretty well with fans. There's one or two other negative, you know, to indifferent type reactions to Rocket on the letters page, but the rest is all pretty positive. Rocket was a pretty fresh idea, or at least a fresh approach to an old idea, taking a traditionally silly concept like a talking animal and presenting the story straightforwardly alongside an established, quote, serious character in the Marvel Universe, being the Hulk. Plus, by using a character like the Hulk to introduce Rocket during the height of the Hulk's popularity, it exposed Rocket to a lot of readers, and the positive reactions doubtlessly helped Mantlow get the leverage he needed to make the miniseries happen a few years down the road. So Rocket Raccoon really kind of owes the Hulk a debt for sharing his platform. Yeah, Mantlow knew what he was doing. Took that opportunity to reintroduce his raccoon character on this book that he was writing at the time and was just red hot. Coincidentally, Rocket probably owes a few other green fellas a tip of the hat for his success, but we'll go over that next episode. So yeah, I was excited to get to this issue, and even though I've read it tons of times over the years, it never disappoints. When I had this comic when I was a kid, but I lost it at some point or gave it to my brother or something like that. But I picked it up again, probably about 25 years ago, late 90s. I got it for something around $2, I think. It was nothing. But that was before the Guardians comics and certainly before the movie. Today, if you wanted a copy of this comic, if it's graded about 9.5 or above, it has sold anywhere from $500 to $1,300. And even at a low grade, you probably wouldn't be able to find it for too much less than $75. But of course, you can read it online with a Marvel Unlimited subscription, should you be desperate to check it out. Marvel Unlimited may even have a free trial or something, I'm not sure. Might be worth checking out if you want to read the issue and don't already have it. And that is, I suppose, a wrap on Incredible Hulk number 271. I can't think of anything else to say about it. Next episode, we'll be delving into the 1985 Rocket Raccoon 4-issue miniseries, something I am very excited about. I love this series with Mike Mignola artwork. Doesn't get much cooler. Now, I'm not sure yet. I may do each of the 4 issues as their own episode of the podcast, or I may decide to double up and do issues 1 and 2 for one episode and 3 and 4 for the next. It'll probably depend on how much I can find to say about them, how much interesting backstory there is to dig into, stuff like that. It'll just mean skimming through the story a little quicker if I double up, but that might be okay. Might be a good experiment. We'll see. We'll see what happens. So yeah, it took me a little while to get the second episode out, and I'm afraid episode 3 will probably take even longer, because I'm going to be traveling a bit next month away from home, so I probably won't be recording till October. But hopefully, while I'm traveling, I can do all my preparation, and when I get back, I can get straight to recording and maybe even get the next 2 episodes out before Halloween. Dare to dream. Before I forget, I want to thank Bandit Gear for the Heroic Beasts theme song. He was nice enough to do that up for me, and I love it. Very 80s, which is my jam. So thanks again, Bandit, for setting me up with that. Great job. And you can find a link to his work in the show notes. You can also find links to both the audio and video versions of the show in the show notes, depending on which version you're experiencing. If you want to check out the other format, you can find those there. If you want to find me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, all as Brink Bunny. That's BRYNK. You can also follow the show Heroic Beasts on Twitter at Heroic Beasts. On that feed, I'll post things like links to the episodes where you can watch them, listen to them, links to things I talk about in the episodes, as well as panels and art from the issues I talk about on the show. DMs are open on Twitter, both for me and the podcast account, so please feel free to send long feedback. Tell me your thoughts on the issues we cover, your thoughts on Rocket Raccoon, I don't know, your grocery list, whatever you want to share about Anthro Comics characters. And I think that about does it for the second episode of Heroic Beasts. Thanks for joining me again, or the first time, and listening to me ramble about talking animals. Yeah, I guess stay safe, be good, and till we meet again on Half World, see you, Space Raccoon Cowboy.